Well, thank you very much, Father Christensen. So we have a good 20 minutes or so for conversation, which is terrific. There's an enormous amount of stuff on the table. Well, the only thing we ask is that when you ask your question, you introduce yourself so that everyone else in the room knows who's speaking. So the floor is yours.
Yes.
Joe Quinn.
So Joe.
Does pacifism imply never use violence, or it's just an absolute last resort?
No, it means never use violence.
And so would those folks reject this doctrine of responsibility to protect, or would they say, we're doing it, we're just doing it with other means, which, of course, in many cases are totally ineffective means?
Yeah, well, yeah. Some pacifists will say, yeah, we practice active nonviolence, and that you can do that in situations of conflict to some extent with limited effect. Others will say, no, we're non-resistant pacifists. Classically Mennonite, and there are fewer of them today than there were.
Yeah.
But classic Mennonite would say, no, we resist any involvement in conflict.
And so in the Catholic tradition, is there a strong pacifist tradition, or are you saying that's really not important anymore?
Well, I would say that the different time, certainly in the beginning, there was a strong pacifist position. In the period between Augustine and the rise of the absolute monarchies, there were strong pacifist movements, but things hadn't consolidated yet. So at different times, there was different degrees of resistance to war, and different methods, different approaches to how you'd resist that war. Today's, the kind of involved Mennonites that I was involved with the International Catholic Mennonite Dialogue, would look to find other ways. I mean, Jean-Paul Lederach, who's at Notre Dame, is the leading Mennonite practitioner of conflict resolution. Well, he's gone from conflict resolution to conflict transformation, and he's working all over the world with all sorts of groups. And increasingly, Catholics are talking about peacemaking as where they're going. And that's why we described ourselves in the document we did with Call Together to Be Peacemakers, the document of the dialogue. We said we're a peacemaking church. We're not a pacifist church, but we only make peace. And so they're working with Mennonites on various, learning various techniques and being applying it in different parts of the world that are zones of conflict. Yes.
Bill Warren,
yeah, Bill.
The church generally doesn't approve of the Berrigan brothers' approach to nonviolence, does it? Isn't that kind of too aggressive, a kind of a confrontational approach that, in general, it's not recognized officially by the church?
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's any kind of official recognition of it. I would say that if you want to talk about nonviolence in the Catholic tradition, it's more in keeping with what the Quakers have a term for it. They call it what's the term? Rather, they don't do civil disobedience. They basically kind of do a civil encounter. The idea is you create a confrontation where you'll meet and then you talk to people about it. Because the Catholic tradition is much stronger on the basis of society being friendship, and therefore what you would do would be to try to engage people. And during the sanctuary movement, there were groups led by Quakers that would do that with the border guards. They would have a demonstration and then engage the border, and then many of them became friends, and the border guards became very sympathetic, and not necessarily in doing their duties, but generally in life. And that eased the situation greatly. I think confrontational... myself, after living in Berkeley for just a few years, I felt that confrontational styles of civil disobedience are part of validating one's own identity more than they were trying to accomplish some good.
Would you say it's consistent with the church's long history to say that non-resistance to evil, in the sense that returning good for evil, Don't spend too much time resisting the evil, but go out and do some good in order to overcome the evil. That kind of so-called non-resistance would be more typical the church's position rather than Resisting evil directly?
No, no, we're using the language differently.
Oh, okay.
In religious sociology and theology, non-resistant pacifism would be groups that believe you always have to turn the other cheek. So if a family member is going to be killed, you won't rise to defend them. You know, that's non-resistant pacifism. It's turn the other cheek kind of pacifism. Resistance is not nonviolent resistance. It's active nonviolent resistance, taking steps to prevent it. Now, the church hasn't taken a formal position, it seems to me, on pacifism. But in practice, I think pacifists are accepted in the church now and honored in a way they never were before. I think that's become the actual pastoral practice of the church. But Ray, would you have something to say about that?
I think it is a far more accepted thing now. I've always found that I'm Ray Helmicky. Yeah, you know, I'm very deep into this. I work with people in these situations, and I'm always much more inclined to enter into a dialogue with the most violent group there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how far I'm representative of the Holy Church,
mm-hmm.
but it's a very fixed procedure for me. If I'm not talking to the person who is regarded as the most trouble in the situation, I'm simply not talking to the right people.
Yeah.
May I follow up with one more?
Yeah, sure, Bill. Okay.
Good.
The church recent canonization of Franz Jagerstatter, you would regard him as a pacifist, I presume, but isn't this an indication that the church is moving pretty definitely in that direction of
That's one of the things that canonizations do. They ratify a certain style of life within the church, and I think it does that. In the case of Jagerstatter, I'm not sure whether you can see him as a pacifist or as a just applying the just war seriously, saying this is an evil regime, and I'm not going to participate in. It's wars because what it's doing is evil. Certainly, a lot of pastors draw a lot of support, a feeling of support from his his beatification. Yes.
Yeah. Mary, and then did you have
your hand
up?
No.
Okay, Alan, go ahead.
There's Dorothy Day and all.
Dorothy Day is both a pacifist and a nonviolent activist. Yeah,
yes.
And she's in the process of being beatified too.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
But where is that? I just don't know if actually, how far along is that?
I'm not sure how far along it is. You don't hear talk about the case advancing very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
right.
I just had a couple of observations here. One of them. We're inclined to associate the pacifism, the nonviolence, all of that, with a kind of liberal left wing in the church. At the Second Vatican Council, when they came to this in the debate over Gaudium and Spes, the strongest opponent of both war and nuclear arms happened to be Alfredo
that's
Ottaviani.
Right, that's right.
His faction was not with him.
Mm-hmm.
The other observation I'd make is that in the current public debate, wider than the church, both the right to resist, or the not the right to resist, the responsibility to protect, the R2P thing,
mm-hmm.
is taking terribly heavy knocks.
Oh, yeah,
in
yeah.
all of the UN yeah. debate over Syria.
Right.
This is regarded as the enemy.
Yeah. By whom?
Well, by a lot of the speakers. I don't have a list of names in my head for them, but certainly. Different countries intervening over the Syrian question. And a lot of the commentary we've had from within American government, very often from these people who, for reasons that they are speaking policy, are remaining anonymous.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right to protect is...
It puts obligations on rulers or governments that they don't want to acknowledge, you know, because they're not politically convenient.
Like the Genocide Convention.
Right, yeah.
Signatory countries
right.
have obligations which they try to avoid.
Yeah, that's right. The role of friendship is real important in the story of Ottaviani. Ottaviani was head of the Holy Office, which later the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. So he was the enforcer of Catholic doctrine in his day, and one of the leaders of the conservative faction in the church and of Vatican II. But in 1950, a French railway worker named Jean Gosse, who had a kind of mystical experience, became a pacifist after witnessing the debacle at Dunkirk. He forced his way into Ottaviani's office. And he and his wife, over a series of years, had conversations with Ottaviani about their pacifism, and reinforced Ottaviani's horror at what had been done to southern Italy during World War II by the bombings. He had been down in the Naples area and witnessed that and had a personal horror of war because of that. So these together they forged an alliance, and Ottaviani was opposed to the church becoming pacifist, but he did recognize the importance of nonviolence, and that's why the document is the way it is.
Could you speak a bit to the question of presumptions in the just war tradition against war, as opposed to the presumption for justice, and how this conversation about these two things is reflected in this question of active nonviolence?
Okay. The way it's put is James Turner Johnson, who's probably the leading historian of just war in the United States, he's taught at Rutgers, he argued against the bishop's position on presumption against the use of war, saying that the presumption is always for justice, for bringing about the good over avoidance of war. Well, if you go back and you look at the major, and he said you won't find this presumption against war in any of the classic voices, and it's not true. I debated him at the Naval Academy, and I went back and said, well, Augustine is always preoccupied with returning to peace, and he has certain passages in his letters and so on where he says, you know, if the other side puts down its arms or sues for peace, you got to stop immediately, and you can't take vengeance on the other side. There are all sorts of things which say your goal is peace to start with. Mm-hmm. And it was very important there. Aquinas, you know, people dismiss the notion that since Aquinas has you know, an article in which he says, well, is war always a sin? And they dismiss the question. And they say, well, then he goes on to explain that you can have a just war. But his explanation of just war is the exception, you know? If you look at all the other questions where Aquinas is asking about certain vices, whether they're are evils, whether they're a sin, the answer is yes. You know, and he's clearly stating an exception. You look at Calvin and Luther. You look at Victorian Suarez. If you look at their statements, they always begin with great presumptions of against the use of force, invocations of Christ as a peacemaker. Luther cites one of the electors of Saxony, who was, I think it's the emperor, the elector Frederick, who was always war was always the last resort. So I think if you look at all those classic Christian sources, there is a presumption against going to war, you know. Justice needs to be done, but war is to be avoided if possible. Now, you wanted me to do it secondly?
How does that conversation, which is refreshed now in the conditions of Syria and things, or what is pulling us, how does that refract into this church teaching on nonviolence? You've spoken about active nonviolence as something that the
right.
church is encouraging people to act for peace.
Yeah.
But does that satisfy the call to act for justice, I guess, is the subtext of my question. Does that allow to get back into that conversation about justice?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the reality is that the way we look at it is under R2P, and it seems that R2P continues to involve just war judgments when you go to the question of enforcement. And there you have to take judgments of proportionality and of success seriously. And I think that looking at that, almost any analysts would tell you, even amateur analysts are going to tell you, this is a disaster. You know, you'd only make things worse, as Pope John Paul II said. But you are required to do something. So what do you do? Well, it seems to me you do a much better job at helping those who have already been refugees. You create great allowances for the admission of refugees. And you create humanitarian access for those who are caught in the country. And then you bring the sides to the table. You know, we're trying to bring the sides to the table, but we're not increasing the resources or the energy we're putting into saving the refugees. They're in a critical kind of situation right now. So we're not doing all that we can, and both non-line of activists and I think just war types can tell you that's what you're obligated to do in this circumstance.
Mm-hmm. One more.
Yeah, Bill.
When we went into that war in Iraq, it seemed like the Pope John Paul II, he was pretty firmly against it. But we didn't hear too much from our bishops here in the country. I presume that they, in general, agreed that it was not justified under just war criteria that we start the war in Iraq. But the bishops kept pretty quiet about it, didn't they? Do they really believe it? Or isn't it generally true that most theologians believe that it did not meet just war criteria, yeah, but they play it down, they don't like to talk about it?
Well, there are two wars in Iraq. There's the first Gulf War in 1991, and even then, John Paul II was very opposed to that war. Mm-hmm. And he had to clarify this famous interview with Frantagiarni, in which he said, kind of screamed out, I'm not a pacifist. But he thought that the outcomes of war are worse than the evil you're dealing with. You need to find other ways to deal with the evil. But certainly the Roman hierarchy opposed the war. They sent Cardinal Laghi to speak to President Bush, and you know, mm-hmm, he wasn't given a hearing at all, or any of the usual privileges that diplomats at that level would be given, like speaking to the press afterwards. He was denied all that. The bishops made several interventions to prevent the war. I was at a meeting. My last meeting as an advisor to the bishops in 2002, in May of 2002, we met with Condoleezza Rice. Said, if you're going to be involved in the Middle East, solve the Palestinian question. Don't get involved in Iraq. It's a fool's journey. And she was adamant that they were going to go to Iraq. Now, this is, 10 months before they go into Iraq, that they were going to go in. The bishops, I think, were divided. So their statement in February, so the month before, when it was the strongest statement they had made, and said a war in Iraq will in no way meet any of the criteria of the just war. When they went about trying to look at their policy the following fall, I really pushed that they go through that earlier statement. And by that time, Bishop O'Brien, who was head of the military archdiocese, was on the committee of international policy, and he resisted that, so that they took a much softer line. So there is internal politics. They didn't do due diligence. Now, part of it's they're worried about the compromise of conscience of Catholics in the military. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a fair amount of politics in it, and they were divided, and they didn't do their job.
Any last questions? If not, we'll...
General context of American policy, we have this really very persuasive teaching of Andrew Bacevich, that right, American policy has chosen war as the preferred option in almost any challenge right the country meets.
Yeah. Yeah.
that does seem to be true to form.
That's right, right. And so the church should be on the outs more frequently than it is.
And when you come to the quiet of the bishops over the question of the Iraq War, it seems to me that our bishops in this kind of situation generally take a Vatican pronunciation as a suggestion and are much more inclined to follow national inclinations.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't in 1983. That was, you know.
Oh, yes.
That's the major exception.
Did a devout Catholic like Bacevich, who's nonetheless a layman, have any influence within the church?
I think he would have influence. I mean, I don't know whether he's been directly consulted, but I've been out of the office in the years when he really came to prominence. But there's certainly a widespread consultation with serious people and serious lay people on the consultants to the Committee on International Policy.
I was just interested in what you were saying about the kind of new acceptance of pacifists within the church, and wonder what you thought about the relationship between, or if there is a difference between a personal pacifism, like the individual approach to pacifism, and the collective responsibility. Like if there's a new acceptance, is that a new acceptance of absolute pacifism or the responsibility as a collective, or is that just an acceptance of individuals practicing or believing in pacifism?
Well, no, I mean, it's clear for even from the Challenge of Peace that pacifism is seen as a vocation. So, but it's a personal vocation that doesn't provide a basis for a state ethic. Okay. But that's the problem in seeing pacifism as the alternative to just war. The alternative is, you know, I think it's more reasonably nonviolence, active nonviolence. Then you can have a state ethic based on active nonviolence most of the time, you know, and only in very great exceptions have the use of force. But pacifism is accepted and I think encouraged, and they're seen as witnesses to the rest of the church as well.
So it has to be a kind of double standard between your personal approach and what the collective has to do.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot in common between non-activists and pacifists.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's not as if they're completely on their own, but I think it seemed to be a very personal, not a position that generally Catholics would be expected to take.
Mm-hmm.
Back here?
No.
Oh, no, okay.
Great. Great, well, thank you so much, Father Christensen.
Thank you for coming.